You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
In the dynamic world of enterprise security, identity architects and IT leaders face a major challenge. Growth by repeated acquisitions multiplies the complexity of everything. Multiple IDPs, MFA providers, policy engines that all need to coexist. This can lead to fragmented user identities and policies that create security vulnerabilities and add access friction. Strata Identity solves this. Now you can decommission unneeded IDPs and consolidate the ones you'd like to keep without rewriting apps or disrupting users, engineers, and app owners. Plus, Strata's modular architecture makes it easy to integrate with any identity provider without manual maintenance and coding. Join the ranks of cybersecurity leaders using identity orchestration. Visit strata.io/cyberwire, share your top identity security priorities, and receive a pair of complimentary AirPods Pro. Offer valid for organizations with over 5,000 employees. Step into a new era of identity management at strata.io/cyberwire.
WinT and other Chinese threats have been active against German and French targets. The U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee has issued the first volume of its report on Russian operations against U.S. elections. This one deals with infrastructure. Louisiana declares a state of cyber emergency over ransomware. Johannesburg's power utility is also hit with ransomware. And you could get up to $175 from the Equifax breach settlement. From the CyberWire studios at DataTribe, I'm Dave Bittner with your CyberWire summary for Friday, July 26, 2019. A joint report by BR and NDR describes the long-running WinT industrial espionage campaign against major German companies. The targets were drawn from the DAX 30, a set of blue-chip companies listed on the Frankfurt Exchange. WinT's operations go back to 2011 and showed a familiar mix of intelligence and criminal motivation. The initial attacks seemed purely criminal and were directed against Karlsruhe-based gaming company GameForge. By 2014, the group had moved on to industrial espionage against chemical and pharmaceutical firms, starting with Dusseldorf's Henkel, whose adhesive technologies were of interest. The operations against French targets had a political motivation, according to L'Opinion. Chinese operators worked to manipulate voting at the UN to prevent a French candidate from election to the international body's agriculture and food portfolio. The U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee has released the first volume of its report on Russian election interference. No new revelations, but the scope, intent, and methods of Russian operations in 2016 are plainly documented. This volume of the report focused on threats to election infrastructure, with a consideration of influence operations to come later. The report concluded that extensive activity targeting election systems had begun by 2014, at least, and that much of that activity targeted state and local election infrastructure. All 50 states received attention from Moscow between 2014 and 2017. The level of activity is alarming, but the good news is that the committee found no indications that votes were changed, vote tallying systems were manipulated, or that any voter registration data was altered or deleted. The federal government did provide warnings at the time, but the committee regards those as insufficient and often directed to the wrong people. Further volumes will no doubt deal with influence operations. In the meantime, The Washington Post notes that it's not just Russia. Other countries, especially Iran, have also gotten into the business. Russia has shown the greater sophistication, but Iran hasn't been too far behind. Russian information operations tend to be opportunistic, their goal being degradation, not persuasion. Iranian operators like to persuade and tend to be a bit one-note, establishing sock puppets that retail stories from Tehran's official media and that tend to focus on the Islamic Republic's line. States of emergency in the U.S. are generally declared in the aftermath of natural disasters like hurricanes and ice storms. Now one has been declared in response to a set of cyber attacks. The governor of Louisiana has declared a state of emergency in response to ransomware attacks on school districts in three northern Louisiana parishes, Sabine, Morehouse, and Wichita. Governor John Bel Edwards has declared the emergency to invoke special powers the state now makes available for response to cyber incidents. Files have been encrypted and systems are generally down throughout the school districts. This is exactly the second time a state has declared an emergency over a cyber attack. Colorado did it last year when its Department of Transportation was hit by SamSam ransomware. A note on Louisiana local government: a parish in Louisiana is what other states would call a county, a level of government between the municipal and the state. It has only an etymological religious significance. A parish is a civil institution. A South African city's electrical utility has been interfered with by a cyber attack. City Power, the electrical utility that serves Johannesburg, was hit by ransomware, according to multiple reports in the local media. The attack didn't cause a power failure, but it did induce a kind of service disruption. Customers who prepay for electricity are unable to do so because many of City Power's public-facing business services have been taken offline. The Johannesburg attack is therefore similar to the incident Baltimore is still recovering from. In the U.S. case, it was water billing. In South Africa, it's electricity. In Baltimore's case, the mayor's office has backed off from earlier claims that the city was hit by rogue NSA Eternal Blue attack code. It now acknowledges that the attack was Robin Hood ransomware and not sinister stuff making its way up I-95 from Fort Meade. The city is still investigating and recovering, but it can't say too much because the investigation is still ongoing. They have released the names of the companies Baltimore has retained to help with the investigation and remediation. They're FireEye, Clark Hill, Secular, Dyntech Services, Microsoft, and Crypsis. So does it scale? Who hasn't asked or at least heard that question? With respect to content moderation, the answer seems to be not painlessly and not without a lot of labor. Content moderation at YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter is largely done in a very labor-intensive fashion, with employees in the Philippines looking at an awful lot of awful, the Washington Post reports. It's not clear that it could be otherwise. Whatever hopes are being vested in the algorithms, they're apparently not up to speed yet. And finally, The Verge and others are explaining how to apply for Equifax breach compensation. Don't expect too much. You might get up to $175 if you're lucky. So don't spend it all in one place.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
And joining me once again is Daniel Prince. He's a senior lecturer in cybersecurity at Lancaster University. Daniel, it's great to have you back. We wanted to talk today about some work that you've been doing about test beds and designing experiments around industrial control systems. What can you share with us today?
Well, thanks for having me back. So we do a lot of work here at Lancaster University around industrial control systems, cybersecurity, particularly around the technological end, the operational technology end. And we've had several years of experience of building large-scale test beds which mimic credibly real-world environments. And we've noticed in the kind of the literature more broadly, there's been quite a significant focus on the creation of test beds and how to create credible test beds that when you perform your experimentation on, you can scale those results up to the different types of implementation, so water or other utilities, for example. But one of the things that we've been starting to look at now is, you know, effectively building the test beds is your really your scientific apparatus. What does it mean to perform high quality scientific experimentation on those? And actually, are we building those test beds as high quality scientific apparatus as well? So it's not just about establishing the credibility, but also how do you actually perform experiments on these industrial control systems test beds so that we can really learn some interesting concepts that we need to take forward into the field.
Can you give us some examples of how those two things intersect?
Yeah, so when we think about building a test bed, one of the things we do is establish that as a scientific apparatus, as a replication of a real-world environment, which is effectively what a lot of scientists do with their lab equipment. They think about how does this chemical reaction, you know, or whatever it might be, the physical experiment, is that representation of a real-world environment. We have really focused on creating the apparatus as best we can. But then how do you actually perform the experiment on top of that? What are the protocols? What are the issues around the apparatus that you're using? What are the restrictions? What are the conditions? So we can't go out and build a whole water treatment work, for example. It's too complicated. There's too many real-world processes. So how, when we're setting up an industrial control systems testbed, how do we make sure that the equipment that we're putting in, so the operational technology, the industrial control systems, that's correct? How are we making sure that the physical processes that we're putting into that, those are correct and they scale up to the real-world environment? But then when we perform the experiment, whatever that might be, so that might be a penetration test, that might be understanding a new industrial intrusion detection system, that might be understanding a new piece of technology for protection that goes in there, how do we ensure experimentally and with experimental rigor that those results would be repeatable within a real-world environment? And if they aren't necessarily 100% the same, what are the caveats that we need to put around the experimental results that anybody taking our information and working in the real world need to understand so that they can put additional maybe security controls in and around that?
How much of this, if any, involves checking in with the folks who have that experience out in the field, the folks who can say, yeah, you know, the manuals all say to do this, but everyone who's out there actually knows that this is something you have to look out for?
That's the credibility aspect. And that's one of the things that in some of the papers that the folks here have written about is one of the sort of the key things that we always try to establish with the apparatus, for example. So whenever we implement, an industrial control system for something like a water treatment plant, we always then try and check that with a range of field engineers or other sort of technical roles. Say, is this actually what would happen? And that establishes the credibility of the testbed, and that's an essential part. But what we're really interested in now is making sure that we are doing rigorous experimentation so that if, say, for example, we gave the same testbed apparatus with the same experiment to somebody else, how do they do that in such a way that they can get similar results? It's not just wildly divergent depending on who does the experiment. We want to really understand what it means to have highly defined experimental protocols around the results production that we can then really take forward into the industry to get them to understand the issues around the experiment, but also to be able to extrapolate those results to two slightly different environments.
All right. Well, Daniel Prince, thanks for joining us.
Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging and time-consuming. Enter Vanta. Vanta gives you one place to centralize and scale your security program. Quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for ISO 27001, SOC 2, and more. You can leverage Vanta's market-leading trust management platform to unify risk management and secure the trust of your customers. Plus, use Vanta AI to save time when completing security questionnaires. CyberWire daily listeners can get $1,000 off by going to vanta.com/cyber. That's vanta.com/cyber.
My guest today is Joseph Menn. He's a longtime investigative reporter on technology issues, currently working for Reuters in San Francisco. He's the author of several books, the latest of which is titled Cult of the Dead Cow, How the Original Hacking Supergroup Might Just Save the World.
So the Cult of the Dead Cow was born in Lubbock, Texas, in either 1984 or 1986. And it started out in the bulletin board era, where people had 300 baud modems, and in order to connect online, it was a tremendous effort and not very satisfying. These guys, the originals, were young teenagers, 11, 12, 13. You know, they'd gotten kicked out of the the local bulletin board for being like too young and ignorant. So they wanted to be elite by themselves. So they created their own bulletin boards. One of them was Demon Roach Underground. So that was the home board of a kid who took the name Swamp Rat, which was later more delicately named Grandmaster Rat. His real name, I put in the book, is Kevin Wheeler. You know, he was a misfit. Most of these kids are misfits. They're smart, but they didn't, you know, fit in with the culture in Texas. And they were really desperate to communicate with each other. So they had these bulletin boards. And back then, frequently only one person could connect at a time.
Right, right.
And so it was really tedious. So by necessity, the early folks are early tech adopters because they're the only ones would have put up with it.
They build this sort of virtual clubhouse for themselves and their other group of friends that they gather together here. So how then does it evolve to sort of common activities and efforts that they're making as a group?
Right. So there are a number of key sort of transitions. In the beginning, what brings them together, this group of, independent bulletin board operators, were the Cult of the Dead Cow text files. So text files are just essays. They could be fiction. They could be nonfiction. They could be about, hey, in the case of the CDC, some of them were about hacking and some of them were just, funny. So it was sort of like underground paper, like underground newspaper, high school underground newspaper type stuff. Some of them were political. They're frequently funny, and sometimes they're obscene. They distributed them, to other bulletin boards, and there were a lot of important marketing decisions that the group made, and one of them was to number these text files. Other bulletin boards would want to have on hand CDC, numbers 1 through 10 or so forth. They wanted a complete set, and so while many other bulletin boards did text files, the CDC ones got spread pretty widely and got, famous for that era of the internet.
As the group grows, are they putting any sorts of guardrails on themselves? I'm thinking of, dealing with things that might be illegal. I remember back in those BBS days, phone phreaking was a popular thing because you had to deal with things like long distance charges. Was there tolerance of that sort of thing, or did they self-police themselves? How did it work?
So this is very interesting, and I go into this in quite a lot of detail in the book. In the beginning, everybody was stealing long-distance service because if the bulletin board wasn't in your area code, then you had to pay long-distance fees, or your parents had to pay long-distance fees in order to connect. And, these... you're going to be online for a while, particularly if you're trying to download anything, program, a game, anything like that. You're going to be connected for a long time, much longer than you would be to just chat to your cousin or some friend on the other side of town. So these kids were all looking at multi-$100 phone bills, and the parents would cut them off after 1 month of that. So they basically all scrambled to get calling card codes, credit card numbers, or other ways, illicit ways, to connect online. And so there was kind of this moral forge that happened where everybody had to consider, you know, what was okay about breaking the law, and was it better? Was it okay morally for some reason to steal from AT&T because they're, you know, they did, you know, you did disapprove of them politically, or they're a monopoly, or whatever. You know, it's hard to justify as an adult, but you know, when you're 13 and you really, really want to connect, you're willing to cut some corners. But what's interesting to me is that people drew their own moral lines. There was a wide variety. Some of the people in CDC did many more things that were considered criminal, but it was never a focal point of the group. And it was for some others, like Legion of Doom, Masters of Deception, quite famously. I mean, they were breaking into all kinds of stuff and you know, hacking each other in pretty serious ways, you know, which led to a lot of them being arrested. And that was never what CDC was about. But I think one of the most interesting things is that these guys who sort of grew up with, you know, figuring out, knowing exactly where the law was and deciding in some cases where to cross that line, actually makes them more reflective about what is appropriate and what isn't than the clean-cut kids that are just coming into cybersecurity today. They went to a nice college and then went for a big company and just start doing cybersecurity things. Those people can be kind of sleepwalked into doing things that they might later think is a bad idea. These guys, a lot of them were really generalists and were really curious about other parts of the security setup. And, you know, one of the things I admire about CDC is that, you know, they went beyond the technical stuff and sort of approached the media and politics with that same sort of critical hacker mindset. We need to make things better writ large. And maybe we don't know anything about how Congress works, but we'll figure it out if we have to.
It strikes me that as a group like this that starts out with a bunch of people who are teenagers and you know, young adults, that it can survive this long, that it can survive that initial group going into adulthood and having to face all the things that all of us do as we become adults with bills to pay and families and so on and so forth, that it's been able to survive those changes, I think is quite remarkable.
It's not only remarkable, it's unique. There is no other U.S. hacking group that has had anything like that kind of a career. It's funny, depending on somebody's age and when they came into the scene, you know, some people will say, oh, yeah, CDC. You know, when I first got online, those are the first text files I saw. And other people that came in a little later, it's like, oh, yeah, I was just starting to hack. And the first tool I used was Back Orifice, which was one of those publicly released anti-Windows tools. And then other people who say, oh, yeah, the first thing I heard about them was I was into politics and I heard about this thing called hacktivism, which is something that the CDC invented. So all these successive phases of security work or sort of internet culture, the CDC was in the forefront.
Now, the subtitle of the book is How the Original Hacking Supergroup Might Just Save the World. What's your notion here that they could be the group to save the world?
Well, they've already done, as I've outlined, some pretty amazing things, right? There's At Stake, which included people like Alex Stamos, who went inside and became chief security officer at Yahoo, which he left on principle after a secret court order asked for Yahoo to turn over, to search all of its users' emails for something. And then he went inside Facebook as chief security officer and blew the whistle on Russian election interference. So I think historically a very important move. Also from At Stake, we get Window Snyder, who was the driving force between Windows XP Service Pack 2 at Microsoft, which was a great leap forward in Microsoft security. And then there's Katie Mazouras, who is sort of known, I guess, as a godmother of the bug bounty movement. She got Microsoft to pay its first bug bounties, got the Pentagon to pay hackers who are also working within a friendly framework. And then there's Veracode. So Chris Rue, the same guy who wrote Back Orifice 2000, the 99 sequel to Back Orifice, founded Veracode with another member of the Loft, Chris Isopel. And Veracode was the allowed big software buyers to see what the binaries in the code that they paid for were actually doing, as opposed to just looking at what the source code thought they should be doing. And that really was another way to tip the scales away from the software oligopolies and monopolies to the customers, who have been generally left in the dark and with very little recourse. So there are those things. There's the entire hacktivist movement, which continues to this day in various flavors. But I think really more than anything, it's the idea of critical thinking, that hackers as sort of outsiders and critical thinkers have tremendous value for society, and this sort of sense of moral purpose. And I think big tech is in a lot of trouble right now, not just security, but big tech is in a lot of trouble right now because it lost touch with those roots, with the sense of technology being something that is supposed to make people's lives better. It's been about, you know, improvements in technology and about profit. And it hasn't really been about helping people. And I think a lot of that is because the people running these companies didn't go through this sort of moral forge that the old school hackers did.
Well, the book is The Cult of the Dead Cow. Joseph Menn, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
And that's the CyberWire. For links to all of today's stories, check out our daily briefing at thecyberwire.com. And for professionals and cybersecurity leaders who want to stay abreast of this rapidly evolving field, sign up for CyberWire Pro. It'll save you time and keep you informed. Listen for us on your Alexa smart speaker, too. The CyberWire podcast is proudly produced in Maryland out of the startup studios of Data Tribe, where they're co-building the next generation of cybersecurity teams and technologies. Our amazing CyberWire team is Elliot Peltzman, Peru Prakash, Stefan Vaziri, Kelsey Bond, Tim Nodar, Joe Kerrigan, Carol Terrio, Ben Yellen, Nick Vilecki, Gina Johnson, Bennett Moe, Chris Russell, John Petrick, Jennifer Iben, Rick Howard, Peter Kilpie, and I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.